A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us this time. He's been open on the podcast about his sensory sensitivity, the way background conversations hijack his focus, and how that plays into his IDRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRRR sense ask, but with a sharper edge. Is there anything he can be doing right now to make sure Ezra develops normal sensory processing? He grew up in a chaotic household. Alcoholic father, domestic stress, and he suspects that environment might have contributed to his own sensory issues, but he doesn't know for sure. So the real question is, can he separate what's genetic from what's environmental, and what's actually in his control?
This hits at exactly the right moment, developmentally. Ezra is 11 months old. The peak window for sensory integration is roughly 6 to 18 months. The clock is ticking on the period where the brain is most plastic for this stuff.
Which is both reassuring and terrifying. Reassuring because he hasn't missed the window. Terrifying because he's right in the middle of it, and the pressure's on.
Let's start with definitions. Sensory processing disorder is not in the DSM-5. It is not a formal psychiatric diagnosis. It is, however, widely recognized in occupational therapy. There's a whole clinical framework for it. Assessment tools like the sensory profile, treatment protocols. The condition describes a brain that struggles to organize and respond to sensory input in a functional way. Some people are over-responsive. Sounds are too loud. Textures are unbearable. Background chatter becomes foreground. Others are under-responsive. They seek out intense sensory input, crashing into things, needing constant movement. Some are both.
It's real, but not officially real.
That's the tension. And it matters for parents because you can't walk into a pediatrician's office and get a diagnosis of sensory processing disorder for your infant the way you might get an autism diagnosis at 18 months. But you can get an occupational therapy evaluation. The label just isn't formalized in the psychiatric manual.
Which is its own kind of frustration. Knowing something's off but not having the paperwork to name it. Daniel mentioned he's never pursued a formal diagnosis for himself either.
That makes sense. By adulthood, most people with sensory sensitivity have built their workarounds. Earplugs, noise-canceling headphones, strategic seating in restaurants. The diagnosis doesn't change much practically. But when it's your kid, the calculus shifts completely. The question stops being, how do I cope, and becomes, can I prevent this? Let's get into it. There are three pillars here. 1. How heritable is sensory processing sensitivity? 2. What role does household stress play in shaping sensory development? And 3. What are the evidence-based interventions a parent can implement right now in the first 2 years?
Start with the genes. How much of this is baked in?
There's a neurophysiological measure called P50 sensory gating. You present two identical auditory clicks, about 500 milliseconds apart, and measure the brain's electrical response via EEG. In a typical brain, the response to the second click is dramatically reduced. The brain goes, I already heard this, I'm dampening it. The reduction is usually 50 to 80%.
The filter works. The brain says, old news, and turns down the volume.
In ADIHD, and in sensory processing issues more broadly, the reduction is often much weaker, 10 to 30%. The second click registers almost as strongly as the first. Translate that to real life. Every repetition of background conversation hits with nearly the same intensity as the first time you noticed it. Your brain never habituates.
Which sounds exhausting.
Twin studies show 50 gating has about 50 to 60% heritability. The foundational work was Friedman and colleagues in the early 2000s, replicated by Turetsky and others in 2022. There's a specific gene variant that keeps showing up, CHRNA7, the alpha-7 nicotinic receptor gene. Variants in that gene are associated with poor sensory gating.
If you've got the variant, your filter is leaky.
Predisposed to be leaky. And that's the key word. 50 to 60% heritability means 40 to 50% of the variance is environmental. That's a lot of room to maneuver.
It does mean Daniel's concern about passing this on isn't unfounded. If he's got poor gating, there's a real chance Ezra inherited some of that architecture.
A 2023 meta-analysis in Frontiers in Integrative Neuroscience found that ADIHD and sensory processing disorder overlap in 40 to 60% of cases. If you've got ADHD, your odds of having clinically significant sensory issues are basically a coin flip. And ADHD itself is highly heritable. Estimates range from 70 to 80%.
The genetic deck is stacked. What about the environment? Daniel mentioned growing up with an alcoholic father and domestic stress. Is that relevant or just confound?
It's not just confound. There's a mechanism. The best evidence comes from the Bucharest Early Intervention Project.
The Romanian Orphanage Study.
After the fall of Ceausescu, tens of thousands of children were in profoundly understaffed institutions. Kids got basic care, but almost no individualized attention. The study took 136 children and randomized them. Some stayed in institutional care, some were placed in high-quality foster care. A control group of never-institutionalized children was also followed.
They tracked sensory processing specifically?
In a 2021 follow-up, they assessed sensory processing at age 8 using the Sensory Profile Questionnaire. Children placed in foster care before 24 months had sensory processing scores within the normal range, indistinguishable from the never-institutionalized controls. Children who remained in institutions showed significant sensory seeking and avoidance behaviors. The early environment had literally reshaped their sensory systems.
The first 2 years are the critical window. If you get responsive caregiving in that period, you can essentially override whatever genetic vulnerability exists.
That's the two-hit hypothesis. Genetic vulnerability is the first hit. The CHRNA7 variant, the family history of ADHD, environmental stress is the second hit. Chaotic household, inconsistent caregiving, high parental stress. When both hits land, you get clinically significant sensory issues. But if you prevent the second hit, the genetic vulnerability may never express clinically.
Which means Daniel's own childhood chaos isn't just a sad backstory. It might be the thing that activated whatever genetic predisposition he had.
That's actually empowering, because the reverse is also true. A calm, responsive environment can de-risk the genetic piece.
Let's talk about what environmental stress actually means at the neurological level.
Chronic stress elevates cortisol. During pregnancy, maternal cortisol crosses the placenta and affects fetal brain development, particularly the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex, both involved in sensory gating and attention regulation. Feldman and colleagues published a 2023 study showing that elevated parental cortisol postnatally is associated with less sensitive, more intrusive parenting behaviors, and this pattern predicts sensory processing difficulties at 18 months.
It's a cascade. Parent is stressed, cortisol goes up, parenting becomes more reactive and less attuned. Infant's sensory system develops in a state of heightened vigilance.
Here's where it gets recursive. A parent with sensory sensitivity is more likely to be stressed by the very things that are normal parts of infant life. Crying, banging toys, the blender. If you're already struggling to filter background noise, adding an infant is like turning the volume from 7 to 11.
Which is exactly Daniel's situation. He's got the sensitivity, he's got the infant, and he's worried his own reactivity is going to shape Ezra's development.
There's a concept called sensory parenting. A parent who startles at loud noises or avoids crowded spaces may inadvertently reduce the infant's exposure to varied sensory input, not out of neglect, out of protection. This is overwhelming for me, so it must be overwhelming for the baby. But the infant needs that varied input to build integration.
It's like the immune system analogy. You don't protect a kid from every germ. You let them encounter some, so the system learns to regulate.
Sensory systems work similarly. They need predictable, varied exposure to calibrate properly. Complete avoidance leads to sensory narrowing, not protection. The goal is not to eliminate sensory input. The goal is to make the input predictable and paired with a calm, responsive caregiver.
The misconception to bust right there. The instinct to shield a sensitive child from triggers is actually counterproductive.
And this is where a lot of well-meaning parenting advice goes wrong.
Okay, so what does the evidence say about actual interventions? What can Daniel do starting today?
Let me walk through three evidence-based approaches. First, what occupational therapists call a sensory diet, structured exposure to varied textures, sounds, and movements during wakeful periods. A 2022 randomized controlled trial of 120 infants showed that infants who received a daily sensory diet had significantly better sensory integration scores at 12 months compared to controls.
What does a sensory diet actually look like for an 11-month-old?
It's not complicated. During tummy time or play, you introduce one novel sensory experience. A new texture, a new sound, a new movement. Could be letting him play with a wooden spoon on a metal bowl. Could be a fabric with a different texture, velvet, burlap, something bumpy. Could be taking him outside to hear birds and traffic. The key is one new thing at a time, during a calm moment, and you let him disengage when he shows signs of overstimulation. Turning away, arching his back, fussing.
You're not flooding him. You're offering a sensory buffet and letting him choose when he's done.
The buffet framing is good. You're expanding the menu, not force-feeding. Parental self-regulation. This is where Daniel's own workarounds become a parenting tool. The 2025 pilot program at the University of Oregon's Child and Family Center took 30 families with high sensory reactive parents and provided 8 weeks of parent coaching focused on helping parents manage their own reactivity so they could remain calm during infant exploration. Infants in the intervention group showed 40% fewer sensory avoidance behaviors at 12 months compared to controls.
40% from just coaching the parents. That's enormous.
The mechanism makes sense. When a parent flinches at a loud noise, the infant reads that signal, that sound is scary. When the parent stays calm, the infant reads that too, that sound is just a sound. The parent's nervous system is co-regulating the infant's.
Daniel's earplugs aren't just a coping mechanism. They're a parenting intervention.
That's the reframe. The recommendation is flat response earplugs, not noise canceling. You want to take the edge off background noise while still being able to hear Ezra. The goal is to stay present and calm, not to check out.
What's the third intervention?
Serve and return interaction. This is the framework from the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard, updated in 2024. The idea is simple. The infant initiates a coo, a reach, a glance, and the parent responds contingently and warmly. The parent follows the child's focus rather than directing it. This back-and-forth pattern is one of the most robust buffers against the negative effects of household chaos on development, including sensory development.
It's not about flashcards or structured activities. It's about being responsive when the baby reaches out.
The research shows it doesn't have to be every single time. Good enough parenting. Winnicott's term is sufficient. The infant doesn't need a perfect parent. They need a parent who gets it right most of the time and repairs when they don't.
Which should be a relief. The standard is not perfection. It's consistency and repair.
Let me tie this back to the cortisol mechanism. When serve and return is working well, the infant's stress response system is being exercised in a healthy way. There's a moment of arousal. I want something, followed by a resolution. I got it. That cycle teaches the brain that stress is manageable. When serve and return breaks down, the infant's stress system stays chronically activated. Cortisol stays elevated, and that shapes the developing sensory circuitry.
The interventions reinforce each other. The sensory diet provides the varied input. Parental self-regulation keeps the parent calm enough to provide serve and return. Serve and return buffers the infant's stress system. It's a virtuous cycle.
The parent's own sensory sensitivity becomes an asset, not a liability. Daniel knows his triggers. He knows what overstimulation feels like. That awareness means he can design Ezra's sensory environment deliberately rather than reactively.
That's a useful reframe. The thing he's worried about passing on is also the thing that makes him attentive to the problem.
There's one more piece. When should a parent actually worry? What's normal variation versus a red flag?
Because at 11 months, kids are weird. They put everything in their mouths. They cry at strange things. They have preferences. How do you distinguish typical from concerning?
The evidence-based markers, drawn from the infant sensory profile 2, normal at 11 months, include startling at loud noises but calming with soothing, showing preferences for certain textures but tolerating others, being wary of strangers but warming up with a familiar caregiver nearby.
The red flags?
persistent aversion to being held, not just occasional squirming, but consistent distress during cuddling. Extreme distress at everyday sounds. Not just being startled, but prolonged crying at the vacuum, the blender, the doorbell, and not being able to be soothed. Refusal to touch certain textures to the point where it interferes with eating or play. If those patterns are persistent and interfere with daily functioning, that's worth an occupational therapy evaluation.
Not a formal SPD diagnosis, because that doesn't exist for infants, but an OT evaluation that can assess sensory processing and recommend interventions.
The earlier the better. The Bucharest study showed the cutoff was 24 months. After that, the brain's sensory architecture is less malleable. Before that, there's significant room to shift the trajectory.
Let's zoom out. Daniel asked whether his childhood stress contributed to his own sensory issues. What's the honest answer?
The honest answer is probably yes, but not in a way that can be definitively proven for any individual. The two-hit model says genetic vulnerability plus environmental stress equals clinical expression. Daniel had both. It's a plausible causal story, but we can't run the counterfactual experiment.
Which is unsatisfying, but honest.
What's more actionable is the forward-looking question. Can we prevent the same pattern from playing out with Ezra? The evidence says yes, partially. You can't change the genes, but you can change the environment. And the environment matters enormously in the first 2 years.
Let me push on one thing. You said sensory avoidance backfires, but is there a risk of overcorrecting, of taking a sensitive kid and flooding them with sensory input in a way that's actually harmful?
That's a crucial distinction. The sensory diet approach is not flooding. Flooding is overwhelming and unpredictable. The sensory diet is structured, predictable, and child-led. The infant sets the pace. When they show signs of overstimulation, you stop. The goal is to expand the window of tolerance gradually, not to break through it.
It's exposure therapy, but for a baby, and with zero coercion.
The parent's calm presence is what makes it tolerable. If the parent is anxious during the exposure, the infant's stress system stays activated and the learning doesn't happen. The parent is the safety signal.
Which brings us back to the earplugs. If Daniel needs to take the edge off the noise to stay calm while Ezra explores a new sound, that's not weakness. That's good design.
The intervention is not toughen up and tolerate more noise. The intervention is use the tools you need to stay regulated so your baby can learn regulation from you.
There's something almost paradoxical here. The parent with sensory sensitivity might actually be the best parent for a sensory sensitive child, because they understand the experience from the inside. The parent who's never been overwhelmed by background noise might not even notice when their kid is struggling.
That's the clinical insight that doesn't get enough attention. Lived experience is information. Daniel's own sensory struggles give him a diagnostic sensitivity that a parent without those struggles might lack. He knows what overstimulation feels like. He can read it in Ezra earlier and more accurately.
The fear is, I'm going to mess up my kid because I'm broken. The evidence suggests something closer to my experience of being broken gives me tools to help my kid that other parents don't have.
That's the reframe. And it's not just feel-good rhetoric, it's grounded in the Oregon study. Parents who understood their own reactivity were better able to manage it, and their infants benefited.
Let's get concrete about what a day might look like. Ezra wakes up. What's the sensory diet approach in practice?
During the first wake window, after feeding, you do tummy time with a textured mat. Maybe one of those mats with different fabric patches. You let him explore. If he reaches for a patch, you name it, that's bumpy. You don't force his hand onto textures he avoids. When he's done, he's done.
What about sounds?
You might have a quiet house for part of the day, but not all of it. Put on music, varied music, not just lullabies. Let him hear the vacuum from the other room, not right next to his ear. The goal is background sounds that are present but not assaultive. If Daniel finds the sounds overwhelming, that's when the flat response earplugs go in, so he can stay in the room and stay calm.
Seven return.
Throughout the day. Ezra looks at something. Daniel follows his gaze and comments. Ezra babbles. Daniel responds. Ezra reaches. Daniel hands him the thing or names it. It's not a scheduled activity. It's a style of interaction.
The red flags to watch for.
If Ezra consistently can't be soothed after startling. If he refuses to touch certain textures to the point where it limits exploration. If everyday sounds produce extreme, prolonged distress. Any of those, and you get the OT evaluation. Not because something is definitely wrong, but because early support is low risk and high reward.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the Bucharest study and the 24-month window. That's both hopeful and anxiety-producing. Hopeful because there's still time. Anxiety-producing because it puts a clock on things.
The clock is real, but it's not a cliff. Neuroplasticity continues throughout childhood. The window is about optimal intervention, not exclusive intervention. Earlier is better, but later is not hopeless. The research shows diminishing returns after 24 months, not zero returns. The brain remains plastic. It's just that the same intervention requires more intensity and more time to achieve the same result.
That's important to say. Parents listening with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old shouldn't think they've missed the boat. Let's talk about the parental stress piece more directly. Daniel grew up with an alcoholic father. That's not just household chaos in the abstract. Is there research on how that kind of stress specifically affects sensory development?
The research on adverse childhood experiences shows that the number of ACEs correlates with sensory processing difficulties later in life. The mechanism is thought to be chronic elevation of cortisol during critical developmental periods. When a child is in a state of constant vigilance, never knowing when the next outburst is coming, the sensory system is calibrated for threat detection, not for filtering. Every sound could be a warning.
The system never learns to habituate, because habituation would be maladaptive. If you tune out the background noise, and the background noise is your father coming up the stairs angry, you miss the warning.
The sensory system is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It's just designed for an environment that requires constant vigilance. The problem arises when the environment changes, but the calibration doesn't. You leave the chaotic household, but your brain is still scanning for threats.
Which is a pretty good description of what Daniel experiences. Background conversations hijacking his attention even when he's safe, even when he knows they're irrelevant.
The brain's filter was trained in an environment where nothing was irrelevant. Everything could be a signal. Unlearning that is difficult.
For Ezra, the intervention is fundamentally about signaling safety. You don't need to scan for threats. The background noise is just noise. You can let it go.
That signal is communicated not through words, but through the parent's nervous system. Calm parent, calm baby. Stressed parent, vigilant baby.
Which puts pressure on the parent to be calm, which is its own paradox. I need to relax so my baby can relax, and now I'm stressed about being stressed.
This is why the good enough framing is so important. The goal is not zero stress. The goal is repair. The parent gets overwhelmed, the parent recovers, the baby sees that stress is temporary and manageable. That's actually more instructive than a parent who's never stressed at all, because real life involves stress, and the skill is regulation, not avoidance.
The occasional moment of parental dysregulation is not a failure. It's a teaching opportunity, if it's followed by repair.
Winnicott's whole point about the good enough mother was that perfect attunement is not the goal. The goal is attunement most of the time, with manageable ruptures and repairs. The repair is where the learning happens.
Let me ask you about the ID-IHD medication piece. You mentioned earlier that methylphenidate partially normalizes P50 gating. If Daniel's on ID-IHD medication, does that affect his sensory parenting?
The 2024 study by Mikulad Franchi and colleagues showed that methylphenidate does improve P50 suppression in adults with ADHDA. It doesn't fully normalize it, but it moves the needle. The implication is straightforward. If medication helps Daniel filter background noise, that's going to make him more present and less reactive with Ezra. It's another tool in the toolkit.
Treating his own ADHD is part of the sensory intervention for his kid.
In a very literal sense. Better gating means less overwhelm, means more capacity for serve and return. The parent's treatment is the child's intervention.
I want to go back to something that might be uncomfortable. The prompt mentions Daniel doesn't have a firm diagnosis and doesn't think it's worth pursuing. But if understanding his own sensory profile helps him parent Ezra, is there value in getting evaluated?
For an adult, the value of a formal evaluation is mostly about self-understanding and access to accommodations. Daniel already has his workarounds. What would change with a diagnosis? Probably not much, practically. But understanding his own sensory profile in detail could help him anticipate what kinds of input might be hard for Ezra, and what kinds might be helpful. It could make his diagnostic sensitivity more precise.
It's not about the label. It's about the map.
If he can articulate, "I'm over-responsive to auditory input, specifically background speech, and under-responsive to proprioceptive input," that's actionable. He knows to watch for auditory sensitivity in Ezra, and he knows to provide lots of proprioceptive input, heavy work, deep pressure, which is often regulating for sensory-sensitive kids.
Proprioceptive input? That's the sense of where your body is in space, the feedback from muscles and joints.
And it's often the unsung hero of sensory integration. Deep pressure, weighted blankets, heavy work like carrying things, these inputs are organizing for the nervous system. For an 11-month-old, proprioceptive input looks like tummy time, crawling, being held firmly, gentle roughhousing. All of those are sensory diet activities that support integration.
The advice isn't just expose him to sounds and textures. It's also let him move, let him push against things, let him feel his body in space.
Movement is sensory integration. Crawling, especially, is a massive sensory integration activity. It involves bilateral coordination, vestibular input, proprioceptive feedback, visual tracking. There's a reason occupational therapists get concerned when kids skip crawling. It's not just a motor milestone. It's a sensory integration milestone.
Ezra's crawling now, so that's happening at the right time.
That's good. The next step is making sure the environment supports varied movement, different surfaces, different inclines, obstacles to navigate. Not a sterile, padded environment, but a safe one with texture and challenge.
Let's talk about what not to do. You mentioned that the instinct to shield a sensitive child from triggers is counterproductive. What are other common mistakes?
One is overstructuring. Some parents try to control every sensory input. Only soft music, only muted colors, no sudden sounds. That creates a sensory environment that's too narrow. The infant's system never learns to handle variation. Then when they encounter the real world, they have no tolerance.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper.
Safe, but developmentally useless. Another mistake is under-responding to genuine distress. Some parents, especially those who've read about not coddling, ignore signs of overstimulation. The baby is arching, turning away, crying, and the parent pushes through because they think the baby needs to get used to it. That's flooding. It doesn't build tolerance, it builds avoidance and dysregulation.
The sweet spot is offer variety. Watch for signals. Back off when the signals say stop. Try again later.
That's the whole approach. It's not complicated. It just requires attention and responsiveness.
Which is, not coincidentally, the definition of serve and return.
These concepts all converge on the same thing. Responsive, attuned caregiving in a varied but not overwhelming environment.
I'm thinking about the cortisol piece again. If Daniel's own childhood stress calibrated his sensory system for vigilance, and he's now trying to create a calm environment for Ezra, is there a risk that his own system is still so calibrated that he's signaling danger even when he thinks he's calm?
That's a sharp question. The answer is yes, there's a risk. If his baseline arousal is elevated, his nervous system may be communicating threat even when he's consciously trying to project calm. This is why the Oregon Parent Coaching Program focused on parental self-regulation first. You can't fake a calm nervous system. You have to actually regulate it.
The earplugs, the medication, the mindfulness, those aren't just for him. They're for Ezra. They're part of the intervention.
Daniel's sensory management is Ezra's sensory environment. The two are inseparable.
Let's pull together the three actionable takeaways, because I think listeners, and Daniel, will want to walk away with something concrete.
First, the sensory buffet. One novel texture, sound, or movement per day during calm play. Let Ezra lead. Let him disengage when he's done. This builds tolerance without flooding. The parental buffer. When background noise is overwhelming, use flat response earplugs. Not to check out, but to stay present without the edge. Your regulation is your child's regulation. Treat your own sensory needs so you can meet your child's. Monitor for red flags, but don't pathologize normal variation. Startling is normal. Prolonged, inconsolable distress at everyday sounds is not. Texture preferences are normal. Refusing to touch entire categories of texture is not. If red flags appear, seek an occupational therapy evaluation. not because something is definitely wrong, but because early support is low risk and high reward.
The through line for all of this, good enough is good enough. You don't need to be perfectly regulated. You don't need to provide a perfectly curated sensory environment. You need to be responsive most of the time, varied in what you offer, and willing to repair when things go wrong.
The evidence supports that. The Bucharest study showed that adequate care, not perfect care, just adequate responsive care, was enough to normalize sensory processing. The bar is high enough to require effort, but low enough to be achievable.
Which should be a relief to any parent listening who's spiraling about whether they're doing enough.
If you're asking the question, you're probably doing enough. The parents who aren't doing enough aren't asking.
Here's where I land on this personally. Daniel can't control what genes he passed to Ezra. He can't rewrite his own childhood. But he can control whether Ezra grows up in a house where the background noise is chaos or curiosity. The evidence says that distinction matters a lot, and the very sensitivity that makes this hard for Daniel is also what makes him the right person to navigate it. He knows the terrain. He knows what overstimulation feels like. He can read it in his kid. That's not a liability. That's a map.
The science keeps coming back to the same insight. The parent's nervous system is the child's environment. If you want to shape the child's sensory development, start by regulating your own. Everything else follows from that.
Will Ezra develop sensory sensitivity regardless of what Daniel does? The genetic piece is real, and it's not fully controllable. But the evidence from the Bucharest study, from the Oregon pilot, from the cortisol research, all of it points in the same direction. A calm, responsive environment in the first 2 years can shift the trajectory, even for genetically vulnerable kids, not with certainty, but with enough probability to make the effort worthwhile.
The effort is not heroic. It's earplugs and tummy time and paying attention. It's ordinary caregiving done with awareness.
I think that's the note to end on. This isn't about being a perfect parent. It's about being a present one. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, Solomon Islands hockey players competing in the Ethiopian Jenna tournament discovered that their carved wooden sticks, when wrapped in pages from local church manuscripts, produced a distinctive whistling sound during slap shots, leading referees to ban singing sticks from competition for 2 seasons until standardized equipment rules were adopted.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got your own sensory parenting strategies or questions, we'd love to hear them. Drop us a note at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.